Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, and most importantly, the people in the region. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how minority Shias in Pakistan continue to live on the edge amid an alarming rise in targeted terrorist attacks. And we shall also take a look at deteriorating relations between Pakistan and the Taliban in the wake of fierce border clashes and violence.
A powerful explosion ripped through a Shia mosque in Pakistan's northwestern city of Peshawar during Friday prayers, killing at least 63 people and injuring 200 others. Described as the deadliest terrorist attack in several years, it targeted a historic mosque in a largely Shia neighborhood of Peshawar, sending shockwaves across the country. Responsibility for the ghastly attack was claimed by the Daesh terrorist group, which has stepped up its activities in the South Asian country in recent years with tacit support from the Pakistani Taliban.
On March the 4th, as worshippers assembled at Kocha Risaldar Mosque in centuries-old Kesahwani Bazaar of Peshawar for Friday prayers, a massive explosion tore through the mosque, leaving a trail of death and destruction. At least 63 people were killed and over 200 injured. Among the victims was prominent Shia cleric Allama Irshad Hussain Khalil. The youngest victim was a 6-year-old boy, Hussain Abbas, from Parachinar. It was the deadliest attack in Pakistan since July 2018, when a Daesh bombing killed 149 people in the city of Quetta. In Peshawar, a city of 2 million people near the border with Afghanistan, an attack of this scale had not been seen since 2014, when Tehrik Taliban Pakistan gunmen attacked an army school, killing 140 people, mostly students. As per eyewitness accounts, a motorcycle-borne assailant mowed down two policemen guarding the mosque before barging inside and detonating his suicide vest. There was dust and smoke everywhere as people ran frantically for their lives. Almost every household in the Shia neighborhood is mourning the loss of their loved ones. Police officials said there was no prior intelligence on the attack, but Prime Minister Imran Khan later admitted that intelligence agencies had all the information regarding the origin of terrorists. On Saturday, police investigators said the suicide bomber and his network had been identified.
Muslim-majority Pakistan has a bloodied history of sectarian violence and persecution of Shias. Violence perpetrated against the minority community by Takfiri terrorist groups has continued unabated for years, forcing many Shias to flee and take refuge in other countries. Those who chose to stay back continue to live on a razor's edge. Almost every city in the country today has a martyr's graveyard for Shias, bearing painful testimony to their unending ordeal. The graves keep piling up, and this time in Peshawar.
Pakistani Shias are among the most vulnerable and the bravest, prone to terrorist attacks. In recent years, groups such as Daesh, Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, Lashkar-e-Jangvi and Sepah-e-Sahaba have carried out a spate of targeted attacks on them, mostly in cities bordering Afghanistan. The latest attack in Peshawar, the capital and the largest city of Khyber Pashtunkhwa province, was claimed by the Daesh terrorist group, which launched its Pakistan chapter in May 2019. The group considers Shias heretics and has claimed many dastardly attacks in the country. Peshawar bombing, however, was the deadliest yet. The carnage in the northwestern Pakistani city has drawn widespread condemnation in and outside the country. Pakistan's President Arif Alvi and Prime Minister Imran Khan, in separate statements, expressed their condolences and vowed action against the perpetrators. Interior Minister Sheikh Rashid Ahmed termed the attack as an attempt to disrupt peace in the country. Imran Khan's government faces intense scrutiny over unchecked violence targeting minority Shias. Shia organizations across Pakistan, including Tehreek Nafaz Fiqh Jafariya, have held peaceful demonstrations over the tragic incident, demanding action against the perpetrators. Protests have spread to other countries as well, with calls in solidarity with Pakistani Shias growing louder.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Shehram Malik, researcher in cybersecurity and contemporary history. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Malik. As we've seen, violence targeting the minority Shia community continues unabated in Pakistan. So why have successive governments in Islamabad failed to crack down on these terrorist groups?
First thing I'd like to challenge you on is that the Shia community in Pakistan is not a minority. They are part of the very fabric of our society. Our founding father was Shia, Muhammad Ali Jinnah. He was belonged to the Ismaili Shia community. Some of our leaders, Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto, Shia, Asif Ali Zardari, who was president of Pakistan recently, he was Shia. Benazir Bhutto was Shia. So this concept that Shias are somehow a minority in Pakistan, we as Pakistanis do not recognize them as minorities. They are one of us. That's the first thing. This goes back to the time post-Iranian revolution when the jihad in Afghanistan started. Certain countries in the Middle East started funding mosques and madrasas within Pakistan and trying to stroke up this hatred not only towards the Americans but also towards the Shia community within the country. I mean, I'll give you my own example. I grew up, I am a Sunni, but I grew up about 10 meters from Imam Bargah. Nobody, none of my parents ever taught me to hate anybody. So this very idea is nonsense. The second thing is the state of Pakistan has been trying. The militant groups in southern Punjab, which were funded by the Middle East, like the big example is Lashkar-e-Jhangvi. They would target Shia Imam Bargahs, Shia mosques. That terrorist organization was completely wiped out by the Pakistani forces, by the Pakistani security apparatus in 2014. Then they found killers in the southern city of Karachi, where they were murdering Shia ulama and also Sunni ulama. And then their network was then basically propagating news within the media that one was done by the other. But the murders were actually performed by the same people, the same groups. And those groups were in fact trained in India. They had links to a guy who lives in England, by the way, not far from where I live, Altaf Hussain. So the state was complicit in the early 80s in allowing this hatred to actually fester and allow these groups to rise up. However, now the state is trying its best to wrap this up and fight these people. But unfortunately, now the foreign players have got involved. They're getting funding. They've got a safe haven in Afghanistan, in areas which the Taliban do not control at the moment. And that is where the struggle is. Now, the state is trying by stabilizing the Taliban government, because that's the only way they'll be able to progress. If there is stable Afghanistan, there will be stable Pakistan.
Now, Mr. Malik, the Peshawar mosque bombing was claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. Now, do you think the Daesh and a Tehreek Taliban Pakistan and other groups are working in tandem?
Just before I answer that question, I am originally from Peshawar. About 2 months ago, I walked past that mosque. That mosque is in the old city of Peshawar, which is a very crowded area. There are a lot of shops in the area. It's an ancient part of the city. So these demons, it's basically an insult to human beings to call these people actually human. The Taliban and Daesh, the TTP, now I'm not talking about the Afghan Taliban here, TTP, the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, are directly linked to Daesh. A lot of their leaders, I mean, I can go through the names, but we do not have time at the moment. They have actually sworn allegiance to the leader of Tehrik-e-Taliban, Daesh, Khorasan. So they are working in tandem. All the splinter groups that have been defeated by the Pakistan military operation in the tribal, previously known as tribal areas, were pushed out. And now they're in Afghanistan. About 6 months ago, they actually got together and swore allegiance to one another, saying that now they will target Pakistan together. So it's a complicated situation. And then to top it all off, you've got foreign funding. I mean, keeping these groups going and providing them with arms, it's not something that just happened. They are getting funding. And I think at this point, I would also like to say that Pakistan also needs support from its neighbors, especially Iran, to hold those countries that fund these organizations to account. Because breaking up the very fabric of the Pakistani society can only happen by creating these chasms within the two major groups that live in Pakistan. 15% of the Pakistani population is Shia. So the most obvious chasm is this. And this is not something that's unknown within the modern fight by Muslims to keep their nations together. We've seen it in Iraq, we've seen it in Syria, we've seen it in Lebanon. So it's a complicated situation that can only be dealt with if we deal with it as a community together.
There you have it, Mr. Shehram Malik, researcher in cybersecurity and contemporary history. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see what people on social media had to say.
Tahir al-Qadri, a top Pakistani Sunni cleric, condemns the Peshawar mosque suicide bombing, saying those who spill the blood of innocents in the house of God cannot be Muslims. Founder and leader of Pakistan's MQM political party, Altaf Hussain, denounces the attack in Peshawar as naked terrorism, which he says raises question marks on the performance of security agencies. Rauf Kiasra, an author and columnist from Islamabad, calls the Peshawar tragedy painful, asserting that people at the helm must be held accountable for this massacre and their inefficiency.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Since the Taliban in a dramatic fashion swept back to power in Afghanistan last August, tensions between the group and Islamabad have grown. Pakistani authorities allege that the Taliban are allowing the Afghan territory to be used by militant groups to attack Pakistan. The group denies the charges, but is infuriated over the construction of a fence by Pakistan along the 2,700-kilometer border with Afghanistan, which has long been a bone of contention between the two sides.
On February the 24th, at least two people were killed and dozens injured in fierce border clashes between Afghanistan's Taliban and Pakistani troops. The firefight resulted from a dispute over the construction of a military checkpoint in a southwestern border area that divides Pakistan's Chaman and Afghanistan's Spin Boldak. Both sides traded accusations over the violence. Taliban spokesperson Zabiullah Mujahid claimed that Pakistani forces were the first to open fire, calling it regrettable. A Pakistani security official was quoted as saying that Taliban fighters made the first move and opened unprovoked fire at them. Thousands of people daily cross the border, mostly from Afghanistan. The Chaman Spinbuldak incident came weeks after intense clashes were reported at a northwestern border post in Khurram district. 5 Pakistani soldiers were killed in the incident, claimed by Tehrik Taliban Pakistan militants allegedly operating from the Afghan territory. It prompted Pakistan's Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi to send a strongly worded message to the Taliban. He said if the group cannot address the concerns of Pakistan, no one will trust them and their promise of cutting ties to Al-Qaeda and other such groups. The statement raised eyebrows in Kabul, where the interim Taliban government has been vigorously campaigning for international legitimacy amid the worsening economic and humanitarian crisis.
The time-tested relations between Pakistan and the Afghan Taliban have developed strains in recent months owing to border skirmishes and disputes over the construction of fencing on the Durand Line, which divides the two neighboring countries. Pakistan has been erecting the fencing to prevent the infiltration of militants from Afghanistan. Taliban, however, doesn't recognize the border, a line adopted by successive governments in Kabul over the years. And now, the protracted border dispute threatens to turn allies into arch foes.
After their government was overthrown by the US-led military coalition in 2001, the top Taliban leadership took refuge in neighboring Pakistan. From their bases in Pakistan, they launched a full-scale armed movement to free Afghanistan from US occupation. The struggle ultimately bore fruit after 20 years, which many saw as a strategic triumph for Islamabad. 7 months on, cracks have already appeared in their relationship, mainly due to the long-standing dispute over the Durand Line. The de facto border created by British colonialists is considered by Afghans a historic mistake. Taliban have adopted the same line, refusing to accept it. Pakistan started fencing the porous border in 2014 to prevent cross-border attacks and smuggling. In recent months, there have been reports of the Taliban attempting to break the fencing in many areas. Taliban's Defense Ministry spokesperson in a statement in January said Pakistan had no right to fence the border and divide ethnic Pashtuns. Amid growing tensions between the two sides over the border fencing, there has also been an alarming uptick in violence with dozens of military personnel killed in attacks on Pakistani army outposts along the border with Afghanistan. Most of these attacks have been claimed by the Pakistani Taliban, who feel emboldened by the Afghan Taliban's dramatic takeover in Kabul.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by political analyst Mr. Akib Mahmood. Welcome to the program, sir. Now, relations between the Taliban and Pakistan appear to have developed strains in recent months following some fierce border clashes. So, has the relationship reached a breaking point?
I don't think it's reached a breaking point because at the moment, the only government that is really engaging with them is the Pakistani government. So the Taliban are shrewd political operators, and they understand that they need to be accepted by the international community. And so I don't think they will put their relationship with the Pakistan government in any kind of jeopardy, especially when they consider that it was Pakistan who brought them to the negotiating table and negotiated the U.S. exit. It was Pakistan who helped them the most throughout the last 20 years and in terms of the U.S. exit from Afghanistan. So I don't think it's at breaking point. Yes, certainly relationships are strained, but they're not overly difficult at the moment. So there will be a diplomatic solution to this somehow.
Mr. Mahmood, Pakistani authorities allege that TTP militants are using the Afghan soil to launch attacks on Pakistan, but Afghan Taliban denies it. So what is the truth in your opinion?
The truth is that the TTP themselves were in a ceasefire with the Pakistan government after the Taliban took over. The Taliban acknowledged at the time that no one will be allowed to use Afghan soil against Pakistan, and they're committed to that. And that's where the ceasefire, that's what the ceasefire was born out of. They wanted Pakistan and the TTP to negotiate a deal of some sort and come to an understanding, because the TTP realized that the Taliban are now the major stakeholder in Afghanistan, and they wanted to be absorbed into the Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, and the Afghan Taliban wanted to ensure that the TTP was on the same page as them vis-a-vis Pakistan, and not using Afghan territory against Pakistan. So that ceasefire ended in December of last year. And since then, we've seen a steady sort of rise in intelligence-based operations against TTP militants and other militant groups that are based in Afghanistan, in Pakistani territory and places like that. So in the border areas, in the former tribal areas. So the truth is somewhere in between, that the Taliban, the TTP, are in Afghanistan, and they are using it against Pakistan.
Now, Mr. Mahmood, let's talk about the construction of a fence by Pakistan on the Durand line, which has also fueled tensions between the two sides. How do you look at this protracted dispute over the de facto border?
The dispute over the border, which is essentially an internationally recognized border and has been consistently for the last 100 or so years, the dispute arises from the fact that the Taliban, the base of the Taliban, is basically the Pashtun tribes of that border region, southern Afghanistan, eastern Afghanistan, which is basically western and southwestern Pakistan. And those people, those Pashtun tribes, are split by that Durand line. So while the Taliban would accept that it's a border, they would not accept it as a hard border. They would not accept it as the way that Pakistan is now fencing that border and creating a barbed wire border with extra security features to ensure no encroachment. So Pakistan is looking after its own security, especially after the last 20 years where Afghan territory has been used against Pakistan. Before, when the Taliban was in power in the 90s, that border was an open border. Anyone could come and go. It was very porous, and Pakistan had no security threat from there. But Pakistan cannot allow it to be used again, as it was in the last 20 years since the American invasion. And so Pakistan is fencing that. This has been discussed quite extensively with the Taliban, and there hopefully will be a diplomatic solution, as the Islamic Emirates have suggested that they will discuss this diplomatically and resolve the issue diplomatically. As far as the incidents of clashes on the border and stuff like that, you've got to understand that the Taliban is not a centralized organization at the moment. It has a lot of disparate organizations which have joined it, and some of them are more nationalist than others, and we'll be looking at the border fence as something which needs to be resisted by violence. So, some of those groups will need to be reined in by the Afghan Taliban leadership.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Aqib Mahmood for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Pakistan-based journalist Salim Shahid reports about the suspension of trade and other business activities between Pakistan and Afghanistan after border clashes between the two sides. Michael Kugelman, the senior associate at the Wilson Center, notes a drop in terrorist incidents after the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, but points to a surge in cross-border attacks from Afghanistan. A Pakistan-based journalist, Iftikhar Firdaus, cites the Pakistani military's media wing as saying that they strongly condemn the use of Afghan soil for militancy directed at Pakistan.
And that was our episode about the relentless persecution of minority Shias in Pakistan and the growing tensions between Pakistan and the Taliban over border skirmishes and violence. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Some Trumpland observers are convinced that he is in serious legal trouble as New York Attorney General investigation of Trump Organization's finances intensifies. We are prepared for you an article written by Ed Pilkington. The piece is titled House of Trump is Crumbling, Why Ex-President's Legal Net is Tightening. When former U.S. President Donald Trump announced plans in 2006 to build a golf complex on ancient sand dunes on the Aberdeenshire coast in Scotland, he told reporters it was love at first sight. He said, "As soon as I saw it, there was no question about it. It would be the world's greatest golf course." Recently, Trump International Scotland became a central element of a case that looks poised to dominate his post-presidential life and could even put him behind bars. Local fishermen denounced Trump as a loudmouth bully during construction of the course. Environmentalists warned the development would destroy the natural habitat, and sure enough, it did inflict such damage that the site was stripped of its protected status. But none of this deflected Trump from his goal. Today, the Scottish complex stands as a premier luxury golf course experience replete with five-star hotel and helicopter landing pad at a bargain membership price of £2,595 a year. 15 years on, the property has done wonders for its owner. That is, if you measure success according to the idiosyncratic accounting style of Donald Trump. He bought the 2,000-acre site at Menny in 2006 for $12.6 million. Within 5 short years, it was valued by the Trump Organization in its financial statements at $161 million, an increase of almost 13 times. By 2014, the windswept Scottish holding was put at $436 million. The hike caught the attention of Letitia James, New York State's progressive attorney general, known for her relentless pursuit of the rich and the powerful. How the Scottish property came to rise meteorically in value is one of the matters she is exploring in her continuing investigation into Trump Organization finances. In a new filing released recently designed to pressure Trump and two of his children, Ivanka and Donald Jr., into facing questions, Letitia James forensically dissects how such strikingly large valuations came about. Her investigators discovered the 2011 estimate for the Scottish property included an estimated £75,000 or $120,000 at 2011 exchange rates for undeveloped land at the site. Investigating deeper, they found that the figure had been created for an article in Forbes magazine. The revelation prompted a line in recent filing that must be among the tartest in US financial history. Letitia James writes, "It thus appears that the valuation of Trump Aberdeen used for Mr. Trump's financial statement was prepared for purposes of providing information to Forbes magazine in a quote. Letitia James's legal document is packed with similarly juicy tidbits. The 2014 value of the Scottish Golf Club was based in part on the projected sale price of 2,500 houses on the land, even though none of the houses actually existed and the company had planning permission for only half that number. In 1995, the Trump Organization bought a parcel of land in Westchester, New York, known as the Seven Springs State, for $7.5 million. By 2004, it was valued at $80 million, and by 2014, at $291 million. Letitia James notes in another exquisitely tart reference that 2014 figure included the valuation of $161 million for seven non-existent mansions. The juiciest tidbits of all concerns Trump's former home, the gilded Fifth Avenue temple of his own ego dubbed Versailles in the Sky, in which he lived before moving into the White House. Letitia James's investigators were puzzled to find the Trump Tower triplex in Manhattan was listed at $327 million in 2015, based on the apartment's size, allegedly 30,000 square feet. In fact, the property is only 11,000 square feet, which produces a value of $117 million. That's an overstatement in Trump's official finance statements of more than $200 million. Letitia James insists in her 114-page filing such startling disparities matter. The financial statements that contained them were used to secure loans from banks as well as insurance and in other instances to reduce Donald Trump's tax burden. Letitia James said that after the filing was lodged in a New York court, "We have uncovered significant evidence that suggests Donald J. Trump and the Trump Organization falsely and fraudulently valued multiple assets and misrepresented those values to financial institutions for economic benefit." The new material disclosed by James was so compelling that some close observers of Trump land are now convinced that he is in serious legal trouble. Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's former personal attorney and an ex-vice president of the Trump Organization, told The Guardian, "The house of Trump is crumbling." Michael Cohen, who was released in November from house arrest, having had his own legal difficulties, has skin in this game. It was his testimony to the House Oversight Committee in February of 2019 that sounded the alarm bells over allegedly inflated evaluations in Trump's financial statements, which in turn prompted the Attorney General, Letitia James, to open her investigation the following month. Michael Cohen said, "My testimony before the committee, as well as my subsequent cooperation with the New York Attorney General, has led to this day. We are seeing individuals who have continuously escaped responsibility for their actions finally being held accountable." Letitia James is pursuing her investigation as a civil case, which means that were Trump to be found liable, it could cost him heavily in fines and penalties. More seriously, James is working in coordination with the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, a similarly tenacious and relentless prosecutor equipped with a large and highly experienced team of investigators. But the times have changed. Donald Trump is no longer a real estate magnate turned reality TV star. He is a former US president. The stakes have increased significantly, and with them the scrutiny. Never before has Trump been confronted by two coordinated teams of sophisticated investigators, raking through his financial affairs, with both civil and criminal charges possibly pending. Just how serious the prosecutors are about nailing their man is revealed in a single sentence of Letitia James's new filing. She writes that the investigative team is determined to find out Mr. Trump's actual knowledge of and intention to make the numerous misstatements and omissions made by him or on his behalf. Intention to make indicates that Letitia James is not only thinking along civil lines, she's also anticipating possible criminal charges in which proof of the intent of the accused is required. Donald Trump continues to resist giving testimony, as do two of his children, on grounds that the investigations are politically motivated witch hunts. Both James and Bragg are Democrats. A third child, Eric Trump, who runs the day-to-day work of the Trump Organization, was deposed but pleaded the fifth more than 500 times. Prosecutors will have to prove that Trump knowingly and willfully violated the law. That can be tough. Showing discrepancies in financial statements, juicy though they may be, is not enough.
Economic Divide.
Before Russia's military operation against Ukraine, Russia and China cemented their ties even further. China's economic commitments to Russia surpass their bilateral trade volume in different sectors. Hi, I'm Kavitavai, and in this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at how Russia will weather its economic war against it with a little help from its friends like China and even Iran. Coming up in this program, as U.S. and the European Union ramp up their pressure against Russia to the fullest, well, China and Russia are combining their resources, China's vast industrial might with Russia's natural resources. Then we will take a look at Russia's and China's economic ties and how it's even been enhanced further. China's promise of increased commodity purchases from oil to coal to wheat. Will that help Russia weather the economic onslaught by mainly Western countries? Only time will tell. Also, we will take a look at this partnership. Is that a reason to threaten the dominance of the dollar? The wheels were in motion before, but given the new world order, plans for de-dollarization may speed up. Russia's and China's payment system and the yuan becoming internationalized.
Russia's military operation against Ukraine has sparked a massive backlash from the U.S. and its European allies. Washington and its European partners have imposed a long list of sanctions on Russia over the crisis. The U.S. and EU have imposed sanctions on Russia's biggest banks and its elite, frozen the assets of the country's central bank located outside of the country, and excluded its financial institutions from the SWIFT bank messaging system. But they have largely allowed its oil and natural gas sales to continue to flow freely to the rest of the world.
Well, there's a lot of ways these sanctions are going to affect companies because both Ukraine and Russia are major commodities exporters, metals, wheat, grain, soybeans. So right away, you've already seen there's going to be a spike in prices of certain commodities that are going to become in short supply. It's the old adage of supply and demand. John McCain famously said that, you know, Russia was a gas station masquerading as a country, but that's not really true. They actually sell many things besides oil and gas. They sell nickel, they sell iron ore, they sell chrome, very, very important metals. Aluminum, I saw that aluminum prices hit a record today. That's going to hurt anybody manufacturing airplanes.
But Russia says it can withstand the pressure. Russia is believed to try to mitigate the impact of the financial penalties by relying on energy sales and leaning on the country's reserves in gold and Chinese currency.
Putin's line is always that the West imposes sanctions no matter what, he does. So he is not communicating publicly connection between his aggressive action and the imposition of sanctions.
Putin also is expected to move funds through smaller banks and accounts of elite families not covered by the sanctions, and to also deal in cryptocurrency. So far, China has refused to join Western sanctions on Russia. Chinese purchases of oil from Russia in December surpasses purchases from Saudi Arabia. Russia announced a deal to sell 100 million tons of coal to China. It has also agreed to buy Russia's wheat amid worries of an agricultural boycott of Russia by the West. Russia and China have also signed a 30-year deal that will allow Russia to supply gas to China, just like the 1950s when China and the Soviet Union began to work closely against the U.S.-led hegemony. Moscow and Beijing have now found common geopolitical interests to work together to circumvent Western pressure. China is already angry at the U.S. over its belligerent policies and its meddling in the affairs of Taipei. China and Russia share a long border. Beijing has turned into Russia's largest source of imports and the biggest destination for its exports.
China's position on the Ukraine issue is consistent. China always decides its position and policy based on the merits of the matter. China does not approve the use of sanctions to solve problems, and even more opposed to unilateral sanctions that have no basis in international law. Practice has long proven that sanctions will not solve problems but create new ones. This will not only result in a lose-lose or losing-all-sides situation in the economy, but also interfere with the process of political settlement.
When it comes to the sanction onslaught against Russia, many don't realize that the U.S. has already sanctioned Russia since the year 2014, along with Europe, for that matter. But the alignment of Russia and China has been in the works for quite some time. China is also another target of U.S. sanctions, by the way. But have the U.S. and Europe thought through the consequences of their actions? Let's take a look at some social media posts on this. That is what this user has asked. Both China and India are reverting to their own currencies and pursuing trade with Russia. The combined population total of these countries is 2.7 billion people. Does the U.S. and its allies, or do the U.S. and the allies realize the long-term strategic consequences of this? Well, analyst Tom Foudy further expanded on this here. China reverts to its own currency in pursuing trade with Russia, opposes sanctions posed by the U.S. and EU against Russia. Amid Moscow's deepening international isolation, he has said and opined that the U.S. might have to face long-standing consequences of strategic changes in trade pacts between China and Russia. Our next post, Russia partnering with China makes the U.S. plan to contain China impossible. The U.S. plan to actually impose a blockade of China's imports through the Malacca Strait would fall apart. Russia would be able to sell whatever gas and oil China needs. The ultimate U.S. goal is China and Russia to stand in the way. And then this post indicates what Europe may realize in the future when it comes to the Ukraine conflict, a kind of reality check, if you will, for Europe. The U.S. has to keep Europe on their side. I am not sure if this will be possible after Ukraine. Those sanctions will hurt Europe massively. Also, Russia will turn to China more after this. Doesn't look so good for U.S. hegemony. All right, joining us for the Q&A in this section of the program is Yuri Maltsev, professor of economics. He has a PhD in labor economics at A.W. Clausen Center for World Business. Okay, Yuri, welcome. Before Russia's military operation against Ukraine, Russia and China actually cemented their economic ties even deeper. It was only natural, since both have faced, obviously, sanctions from the U.S. and are concerned about U.S. moves against them. How important is China for Russia when it comes to what's unfolding in Ukraine?
Of course, it's very important. It's kind of like Well, I hate to say that, but it's kind of like two drunks are trying to cross the street and one is supporting another. And we see a lot of problems in Russian economy, and they're creating more and more problems. And Putin antagonized the whole West against himself and against Russia. From that point of view, definitely China is the only kind of the only kind of partner that he is he's really looking up for, as well as Iran. This is obvious that if you made the West your enemy, then you should look at the East. And China also is interested in Russia because Russia is a great source of all kind of natural resources. And also I'm thinking that in China, there's still a lot of people, at least the people I met there, who would think that Russia can be kind of recolonized by Chinese people in the future.
All right, let me bring in Ken Hammond here. Let's see what he thinks. He is a professor of Global and East Asian Studies at New Mexico University, who is also an activist. And he joins us from Las Cruces in New Mexico. Ken Hammond, welcome. As the U.S. and European Union have become very wary of China, we know that. Leaders in China have decided that their best geopolitical prospects in many respects will be their industrial, in marrying with the vast industrial might that Russia has. Obviously, Russia has a lot of formidable natural resources. Will this put U.S. and Europe maybe on the defense economically?
Well, yeah, I think that China acquires a number of commodities, a number of things from Russia. Natural resources, everything from oil and natural gas to timber to minerals, mining operations and things like that. These are very important resources that China is able to acquire. And of course, those purchases are really helpful contribute a lot to the viability of Russia's economy. China also buys a lot of military equipment and military technology from Russia, and that's very important for China's own modernization, its own military development.
It's time now for the Info News section of the program. It's a good time to actually try to break away from news related to the Ukrainian conflict and look at other economic news from around the world. Well, our first piece of news is on poverty, and it's in Italy, but for foreigners there. According to a report, one in three foreigners in Italy lives in poverty. Poverty affects 29.3% of foreign nationals, compared to 7.5% of Italians, and then 26.7% of families who are composed of only foreign nationals. And I'm sure poverty in Italy actually has affected the general population as a whole also. Now, the next piece takes us to the UK in terms of the energy costs there. Now, we've covered this in our previous programs, but this may jolt you into understanding the real story. Energy bills are set to hit £3,000 this year. That means 40 million are heading for fuel poverty. That's a lot. Now, at the same time, this is where it hurts. British gas company profits, they have risen. How much? 44%. So you can see that they're reaping the benefits at the expense of people. Next up, Yemen. We have not visited this next topic. UNICEF has said that two-thirds of displaced families have no income. But do you hear that in the news? And that is the double standard. The Saudi-led bombing that is occurring in that country barely gets any coverage, but the Ukraine conflict is everywhere. And, of course, on an emotional level, it has reached out to the world as a whole. Why doesn't that happen for Yemen? Our final piece, Nigeria's economy, Africa's largest economy, topped growth forecast. Gross domestic product has expanded to 3.4%. That's topped expectations. That's after shrinking 1.92% in 2020. The non-oil economy expanded by 4.73% in the quarter from a year earlier, with agriculture growing 3.58%. and services increasing 5%. All right, those were some of the topics that we picked. Of course, we always like to hear from you. If you have any topics in mind, where you are, wherever part of the world, we would love to hear from you. Please send us your suggestions.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
When it comes to Russia's relationship with China, trade has been at the forefront of the relationship, mainly due to the dramatic increases between the two countries. That is going to be the focus of our in-depth section. Now, looking at total trade between China and Russia, well, it jumped 35.9% based on the figures that we see here, starting from the year 2017 all the way through 2021, 35.9%. Now, in terms of, and that's a record, $146.87 billion. The commodities which Russia provided China the most, oil, gas, coal, and agricultural commodities, 1.59 million barrels per day is how much it provided China. How much of an important commodity China views Russia for its oil, that it provides that much oil to China on a daily basis. Of course, agricultural products is also another important factor here. Now, in terms of the bilateral trade and why it has increased so much, well, we have to actually go back to the year 2014. China's exports to Russia and imports from Russia in billions of dollars is mentioned. And in terms of what we're looking at, and that's the year when Crimea claimed independence, by the way, from Ukraine, bilateral trade expanded by more than 50%. And this is from the time that the independence was announced. Now, that's over 50%, so much so that China has actually become Russia's biggest export destination. Now, the two will not, however, settle for this increase. They actually want to expand their bilateral trade even more. So for the year 2024 was $200 billion, but then they revised it. They want that figure to increase to $250 billion. So shows the depth of the relationship that these two have. And this was actually unveiled last month during Russian President Vladimir Putin's visit to Beijing for the Winter Olympics, in which the two sides agreed to increase that to $250 billion. Okay, the next challenging feat to achieve between the two is in the area of investment, Chinese investment in Russia. Western sanctions have forced Russia to look toward China for this. Chinese banks have helped Russia finance everything from infrastructure to oil and then to gas projects. This all fell under China's Belt and Road Initiative. Well, Russia is by far Beijing's largest recipient of state sector financing overall, where we take a look at, for example, the 107 loans that have been given from China to Russia over the course of, 17 years, again, as an example, which amounted to $125 billion. I am sure you can bet on this, that that's going to increase based on the sanction onslaught by the West on Russia. All right, let's try to get some analysis into this. Rejoining us is Yuri Maltsev, professor of economics. Yuri Maltsev, welcome back. Food, energy, and banking deals, just the latest signals that we're looking at when it comes to China's economic alignment with Russia. Trade can increase between the two, as I just mentioned, but sanctions leveled against Russia, it's, however, not an effective way to solve problems. How do you see this going forward?
Well, I think that sanctions, they definitely work. And the problem with sanctions, with all kind of sanctions against Russia or against anybody else, that it would be the ordinary people would suffer. Mr. Putin would eat and drink nothing else. I mean, he wouldn't suffer by the sanctions, nor his cronies. But ordinary people, yes, it's already a problem for them to get even out of Russia. It's impossible because the embassies are closed, consular departments are closed, airlines do not travel to Russia. So this is a problem for real people, not for Putin and the likes. But from another hand, I can see that you must do something about it, because he is raping and maiming and killing people in another country with absolutely no justification for that.
Well, Ken Hammond rejoins us. Let's see what he thinks, professor of global and East Asian studies at New Mexico University. Ken Hammond, welcome back. Before Russia's military operation against Ukraine, Russia and China cemented their economic ties even more. And we just covered that. For example, they want to increase their trade to $250 billion per year. At the same time, we're looking at how China is going to need to buy energy and food from Russia. How important is China for Russia in order to weather out what Russia will be going through for a limited period of time, maybe even longer?
I think right now that one of the key things in terms of helping Russia to deal with the pushback from the West, you know, from the United States and NATO, is that China has been working on developing its own system of international settlements, its system of settling financial and commercial transactions between different countries, apart from the SWIFT system. And that SWIFT system is really, in many ways, the most important component of the sanctions that the United States is trying to impose on Russia. China has a system in which international payments can be settled using the Chinese currency, using the renminbi.
The rising tensions between Russia and the West and the sanctions imposed on the country could bring Russia and its allies closer together. One of those allies is Iran. Tehran and Moscow enjoy burgeoning economic and military cooperation. Trade between the two countries has been increasing in recent years, especially after the U.S. quit the nuclear deal and reimposed sanctions on Iran in 2018. Currently, the volume of trade between Iran and Russia is $4 billion. It is expected to reach $10 billion annually following President Raisi's visit to Russia earlier this year. Moscow is reportedly planning to build a new port near the town of Lagan on the Russian Caspian coast. The $1.6 billion port, with a reported capacity of 12.5 million tons, is said to be chiefly aimed at increasing Russia's trade with Iran and also with India. The International North-South Transport Corridor, or INSTC, a 4,500-mile-long transportation system involving rail, road, and shipping routes connecting India to Russia through Iran, could also play a pivotal role to help Russia circumvent sanctions. Iran has plenty of potentials to supply Russia with agricultural and consumer good products. Russia has also developed what's called the SPFS, its own version of SWIFT. The goal of this system would be to recruit numerous international banks, enough participants to deter the threat of Western economic sanctions, particularly from the U.S. That system can help Russian banks to do their transaction with countries like Iran, China, and India. Iran and Russia have also been planning to connect their power grids. The plan could now be implemented to help both countries reap the benefits of their economic cooperation.
The Ukrainian conflict is one that is being closely followed by China, in case China becomes a victim of U.S. and West's harsh sanctions regime. China is particularly looking at Russia's economic and financial vulnerabilities. China has pushed for self-reliance in key economic areas of technology and the payments needed to settle trade to minimize its weaknesses. Those weaknesses include dependence on the U.S. dollar. China has in recent years sought to internationalize its currency, but what does that exactly mean? That means that China has settled more trade with the yuan. Of course, that includes Russia, and when it comes to the yuan, it accounted for 13.1% of the Russian central bank's foreign currency reserves last June, compared with just 0.1% in June 2017. China's central bank is developing a digital currency which would have the benefit of further encouraging yuan settlement for trade. So the role of the yuan is becoming more prominent by the day and will surely accelerate due to the Ukraine conflict. But what about SWIFT? And does China have plans for an alternate payment system like Russia does? The answer is yes, China has an alternative system to bypass SWIFT. It's called the Cross-Border Interbank Payment System, CIPS. This system actually saw a 75% increase in processing volume last year. But it still has a long way to go, since 80% of CIPS transactions still involve SWIFT. Now comes China's reliance on imports. What is it doing about that in